that gave me some kind of a shot, and it relieved it a little bit, but it took a nice 3 months.
When I got here in 2011, December, they came in, they did your examination, they did everything, you know, your dental and everything else. I had a cavity. Actually, I got two cavities now.
This is 51-year-old William Jessup. We heard from him yesterday in our story about Illinois spending big money on people getting convicted of relatively minor crimes. Jessup got a 4-year sentence for having a stolen license plate sticker. But back to his dental problems. It was almost a year and a half ago that Jessup was told about his cavities.
The dentist looked it over and says, well, how long are you going to be here for? I said, well, I got 2 years to do. Well, it's probably going to take that long to fill those cavities, but we'll pull them out for you. No, you're not going to pull my teeth out. Any qualified dentist will tell you it's always best to keep your teeth. I'm assuming it still applies here, but obviously it don't because I still have the two cavities.
They tell you flat out, we can't do nothing for you. They're, you know, unless it's an immediate issue, they're not doing nothing for you.
That's Jeffrey Elders, and we also heard from him yesterday. He was the guy who was sent to prison for trying to steal $111 from JCPenney. His need to fund a drug addiction has repeatedly landed him behind bars. On the palm of his right hand is a hard growth. He holds out his hand to me and pokes at the growth with his fingers.
It's climbing probably about 3 inches up my hand on my tendon. That's all hard, real hard, and then right here's a big old thing. It's pulling that finger in. They say it's a calcium buildup. They call it some kind of hematobin globin or...
It's like there's a hard stick under his skin that runs from his wrist towards the ring finger on his right hand. It branches into two strands as it approaches the knuckle, making the growth under his skin kind of look like the letter Y. And it pulls one finger back, so it's constantly curled, and he can't straighten it out. And it's getting worse. He went to see the prison doctor about the problem.
He said, well, I'll give you some aspirins and I suggest you take care of it as soon as you can when you get out, or you're going to end up like this, you know, all crippled up. But there's nothing we're going to do for you here.
He said you need to get to take it taken care of. But then he said, we're not going to do it.
Exactly. Exactly what he said.
He said,
that's something I suggest you take care of as soon as you get out. He said, I know people that their hand cripples up on them over that.
So what do you make of that, him saying that to you?
That, I don't know, to me, it's what I'm used to. It's the system. Everything's blamed on not enough money. What can you do with that? You know, I have no kind of say-so. If you backtalk anybody, you're in trouble.
I took some of these stories to the guy in charge of Vandalia Prison, Warden Victor Dozier. I told Dozier about Jessup, the man who was told by the dentist that he had cavities and was also told that all they would do for him was pull the teeth.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's hard to believe, but...
I also asked Dozier about Elders and the growth on his hand.
Well, if the offender files a grievance, that's the only way you can follow up on that.
A grievance is a formal complaint inmates can file. However, in the next breath, Dozier all but admits that filing a grievance on a medical issue would be pointless.
I mean, if the doctor states, give him a rationale why he can't do it, I mean, he's our medical director. I can't question what he tells an offender.
Admittedly, a corrections professional should not be overruling the healthcare decisions of a medical professional. But then who does vet the healthcare decisions being made? In written statements given to WBEZ over the last several months, the Department of Corrections has repeatedly said it oversees healthcare, holding, quote, monthly continuous quality improvement meetings. But the department has yet to provide someone who can explain exactly what happens at these meetings, who's involved, or what information they're looking at. According to the prison watchdog group, the John Howard Association, no one seems to be providing meaningful oversight of prison healthcare. In fact, last year, the John Howard Association reported that the state entered into a more than $1.3 billion contract with a company called Wexford Health Sources without auditing the company's previous performance in the state. I asked Warden Dozier how he, as the top official at the Vandalia prison, ensures that Wexford is actually delivering the care that Illinois taxpayers have been paying for.
Okay, I don't have an answer for that.
Well, I've heard, you know, similar stories and actually worse. And I'm very concerned that we're paying about $1.3 billion to a private company to manage health care in our prisons. And I want to look into, are we getting quality health care for the folks for the money that we're paying?
Greg Harris is a state representative who has been looking into Wexford's contract with the state. His interest was piqued by the John Howard Association report last year. Harris says his review of the contract shows that the deal is a good one, as long as Wexford actually provides the care they're supposed to provide.
I mean, we can't take the Department of Corrections' word for it, and we can't take the private company's word for it. I want somebody to go in and independently verify that people are being adequately treated.
Harris is planning to hold a public hearing on April 4th in Chicago to take a closer look at the contract. He's pushing to bring a group, the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare, into Illinois prisons to provide independent oversight. Wexford declined to be interviewed for this story. In fact, the company with a $1 billion public contract in Illinois has refused all of our requests for interviews. However, in a written statement, they say they provide medically necessary care as required by the Constitution, while at the same time acting as responsible stewards of taxpayer dollars. Wexford also says it welcomes Representative Harris's push to bring a third party in to audit Wexford's performance in Illinois' prisons. I'm Robert Wildeboer.
Join us again tomorrow when Rob takes a closer look at the state's rule against reporters using cameras in prisons. The state says it's about safety and security, but the union representing prison workers says it's about Governor Pat Quinn's political agenda. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 12:47. Deflections can determine how the flow of a basketball game can determine the flow of a basketball game, but they are an underused statistic. NPR's Mike Pesca looks at how Rick Pitino of the Louisville Cardinals has come to use deflections and the counting of deflections to motivate his players and intimidate opponents.
The way Mario Batali thinks about black truffles, the penchant Quentin Tarantino has for quoting Hong Kong martial arts films in his own movies, that's the way Louisville head coach Rick Pitino talks about deflections. Why deflections?
If you got 35 deflections, you're going to win 95% of your games.
That's in the NBA at 48 minutes a game. In the 40-minute college game, the number is lower. Louisville has been breaking deflection records this postseason. The deflection doesn't have a set definition. Like King Canute affecting the tide, each college coach gets to personally define deflections. A deflection can occur when a defensive player in any way redirects the intended flight of the ball. Indiana coach Tom Crean, the other big-time college coach who's always talking about the stat, counts drawing charges as deflections. Pitino doesn't, but he does count corralling loose balls as a deflection. Pitino has been charting this phenomenon for over 30 years, including his first stint with the New York Knicks under legendary coach Hubie Brown. Brown allowed his young assistant to post the team's deflection stats on the blackboard at halftime.
Ray Williams, 2 deflections. Lewis Ord, 3 deflections.
But Pitino left off the players without a deflection. Soon, Hubie Brown's voice was heard, questioning the exclusion of the Knicks players who hadn't recorded a deflection.
Where did he have for the other guys?
Brown, who remembers the moment well, says that deflections are the kind of stat that reveal a great deal about a team's defensive effort.
Whether we were up for this game, whether we were just in second gear, or whether we needed a major transformation of getting after people.
And the habit of shaming the non-deflector lives on. Louisville guard Kevin Ware is a part of the grand tradition of fearing the wrath of a deflection-obsessed coach.
Every halftime, every game, they'll have the deflections tallied up, how many you got, and Coach Pia, he's really big on deflections, so if you're playing minutes and you're not getting deflections, there's something wrong.
The great beauty of the deflection is that it makes the ephemeral tangible. Most of the stats kept in basketball relate to offense, like points and shooting percentage and assists. Telling a player in a timeout to play hard defense is vague, and telling him to get a steal is requesting an outcome. But speaking of deflections is to emphasize a specific action, which gives the player a sense of control. Brown, a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame, says so much of communicating with players in pressure situations who are dealing with crowds and adrenaline and opponents is to make instructions understandable.
You have to be able to short-term them when you talk to your players so that they retain what's going on.
This tournament, members of the Virginia Commonwealth staff were seen on the sidelines counting deflections in checkers on a Connect Four set. Louisville and Indiana keep their own private tallies. The only real way for the public to get a handle on their number is to subscribe to a service which counts them. Well, there is another way to get a sense of deflections. In this tournament, deflections have been offering a direct correlation to a team's chances of making the Final Four. Mike Pesca, NPR News.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 28th of March, 2013. It's the birthday of Nelson Algren, 1909, Detroit. He grew up in Chicago's immigrant neighborhoods, wrote his first story, So Help Me, during the Great Depression while he was working at a gas station in Texas. Nelson Algren was caught stealing a typewriter, spent 5 months in jail, and after that his work was about the down and out, the loser, the reject. He became known as a writer of Chicago, Algren, who said, if a writer could write the truth about one Chicago street, that would be a good life's work. A Walk on the Wild Side, set in the world of pimps and prostitutes in New Orleans. It was in that book that Algren gave his famous three rules for life. Never play cards with a man called Doc. Never eat at a place called Mom's. Never sleep with a woman whose troubles are worse than your own. Nelson Algren said, a certain ruthlessness and a sense of alienation from society is as essential to creative writing as it is to armed robbery. It's the birthday of Mario Vargas Llosa, born in Arequipa in southern Peru, 1936, went to a military academy in Lima, which he hated and which inspired his first novel, The Time of the Hero. He ran for the presidency of Peru in 1990 against Alberto Fujimori. He lost. Llosa subsequently renounced politics. He said literature and politics are mutually exclusive. A writer is someone who works alone, who needs total independence. A politician is someone who is totally dependent, who has to make all kinds of concessions, the very thing a writer can't do.